Добрый день. This is Yuri from Breckenridge, Colorado. You're listening to the Fly Fishing Consultant podcast with Rob Snowwhite, produced by producer Jason. Спасибо. What does podcast mean?
From the nation's capital, this is the Fly Fishing Consultant podcast with your host, Rob Snowwhite.
Thank you for downloading my fly fishing podcast. Recently, I was flipping through the new The Fly Shop catalog and came across a pic of a dude with a big two-handed rod standing chest deep in water throwing a massive skagit head. His name's Justin Miller, and he leads travel trips around the world for The Fly Shop. So I had to get him on the show to tell us about fly fishing in Russia. So we're going to hear that in a minute. But first, this episode is brought to you by the Negrini case. Are you headed to Kamchatka or Kola Peninsula with Justin? It may be a short road trip to the in-laws for the weekend. You're going to need to protect your gear. The new Sea Run fly fishing cases are the next evolution of fly fishing travel cases. A proper hard-shielded, checkable luggage that gets you to your destination with peace of mind, TSA compliant, and airline approved for travel. Models run from luxury to premium with the option of a protective duffel bag like cover. The patented double wall system consists of tough inner and outer shells welded together to yield maximum impact strength and resistance to all weather conditions. The results are an ultralight, ultra strong, practical fly fishing case able to handle the worst handling and deliver the best performance. You first notice the smell of the luggage when you open the packaging. The high-quality leather reminds me of the aroma passing by the Georgetown leather store at Tyson's Mall as a kid. And once you open up the case, you'll find compartments for tools, gadgets, knickknacks, and snacks. You can store rods up to 9 feet long with the current models, and there are modular foam hockey pucks that pop out where you can snugly fit your reel. Sea-Run cases provide the best protection for gear in the field, truck, or the checked baggage of a plane. Visit SeaRunCases.com for more information.
All right, so we have Justin Miller. Justin, where are you exactly right now?
So I work for the Fly Shop in Northern California. We're 43 years. We've been in business. One of the biggest fly shops in the country. Lots of you guys probably get our catalog and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And we do retail and then local guide service in Northern California. Then we do international travel business as well. Some of our bosses and stuff, the owner of the fly shop is one of the pioneers in traveling a bunch of places all over the world. And so I'm Mike. Back in that department these days.
And that's Mike.
Been a little rough in 2020, but we're getting back online.
Yeah. All right. So for those who haven't seen you before, met you, who do you look like that we might recognize and picture while we're listening?
I don't know, man. Just who do I look like? I don't know. I got a big red beard, man.
Okay. Like a Viking. We'll go with that.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. So how did you start working at the fly shop? Where did your fishing career and love of fish come from?
Yeah, so I grew up in California in the Bay Area in Oakland, and then I worked at a summer camp in the Sierras. That's where I learned how to fish. And then when I was in college in Chico State, that's when I started fishing crazy style every single day after school, got into steelhead fishing and was all about it. And then, and I was studying steelhead in college and everything. And then when I graduated, I found a job working for the Fly Shop's fish camp, a summer camp for kids. And they hired me for that position that summer after I graduated, and I didn't have any place else to go at the end of the summer. And they asked if I wanted to stick around. So I moved to Reading and started in with them.
Fantastic. So why were you studying steelhead? What was it about them? And were you studying them before you caught them with the fly rod?
Kind of like the same time, you know, I started getting into chasing them. And then, so I was a environmental geography major at Chico State. And then, so, you know, I was thinking about them every day, chasing them with the rod. So then when I got to the books in the library, that's also what I wanted to read about and follow. In the major that I had, let me do that. Let me follow them, read more about them. Also lots of salmon too. I was reading a lot about, you know, Chinook and other salmonids in California and stuff. That's kind of what we were reading and writing about.
So your class time, you get to do your lab outside with the fly rod?
Pretty much, man. That was it.
What was it like when you landed your first steelhead?
It would have been my first year at Chico, so that would have been like 2001 or something.
Okay. And do you consider Great Lakes steelhead to be real steelhead? Do you even think about them?
Oh, man. I don't want to make everybody upset, but man, you know how it is. If you're on the West Coast, no, you don't think that. You know, the thing is that I always tell guys, because I don't want to be, you know, put down or anything like that, because I know some of those fish are amazing, you know, but the definition of steelhead is that they go to an ocean and back. And I know the Great Lakes are big, but there's no salt, there's no sharks, there's no sea lions and the like. So, you know, I don't understand why guys don't claim to have the greatest lake run rainbow system in the world, or lake run Chinook, or, you know, anything else, landlocked something, but you know.
Does the fly shop do any travel to the Great Lakes?
We do not. We do not. And not out of, you know, honestly, I mean, so we don't do too much. We're just starting, actually, due to the pandemic and stuff, doing more destination travel in the lower 48 states. So it's not that we're anti-Great Lakes by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that we've never done travel in the lower 48. We don't do Florida either, you know, and we've never done Montana for that matter. And, you know, that's one of the most famous places in the world for fly fishing. It's just not in our area. So we've always been pretty much international travel, including Alaska and then our local Northern California stuff. But like I said, we're just starting to branch out into the lower 48 and starting to book, you know, those Rocky Mountain trout destinations, Florida tarpon, Louisiana redfish, you know, Olympic Peninsula steelhead, and some of those other destinations we have in our own country in the lower 48 that are pretty exceptional that we've been looking past.
How about bluegill in Washington, D.C.?
Sounds awesome, man. I don't know if I can sell it, but
we got snakehead, walleye, bass. I mean, whatever you want, it's in the river here.
That's awesome. That's
pretty crazy.
I'd be fishing it if that's where I was. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, what's it like working with a fly designer like Mike Mercer? You get to pick his brain.
Oh yeah, man. So yeah, man. I mean, Mercer's the absolute legend. Absolutely. So I learned a bunch from him, you know, when I was a lot younger. I learned so much from him in tying trout flies and nymphing. I mean, the guy's one of the greatest trout fishermen of all time. Now we make fun of each other a lot. I tend to swing flies with spay rods, big steelhead deal, you know, and he's still the god of nymphing. And so we poke a lot of fun at that, just like the Great Lakes West Coast things. It's the same thing with the spay nymph thing, right? You get the poke a little fun, but, you know, not too serious. Right, but on. Yeah, he's a legend. He's a legend with a single hander on a dead drift, man.
Yeah, I need to get him on here at some point. It's been a long time.
Absolutely.
So how you said Mike started the Mike, the owner, started the travel business. When did that start going, and how did he decide to throw travel into his fly shop to international destinations?
Yeah, I mean that was long before my time. He likes to rub that in that he's been doing this since before I was born. So I don't know if it was, I mean, you know, that, you know, this is late 70s, and those guys are just fish bums, and the world was, you know, open. Travel was starting to get easier, but there weren't those big lodges. You know, they were just, Alaska was there. And they were learning from that and then expanding it into new places, right? So they were just starting to do the Chile and Argentina. That'd be the, you know, they put that stuff on the map for international trout fishing. And that's what we were doing in NorCal. And then it just kind of expanded from there. Right. Then, you know, once they were established, you know, they were on the lead edge of the saltwater game in the Bahamas, on Belize and all that stuff. And then, yeah, you know, it just snowballed. Then they were in place, knew how to do it, all the marketing. So when Kamchatka came around in the early 90s, they were first into that game. And so it just snowballed, but started like we all were, right? Just some fish bums that wanted to go fishing. They just took it further.
Yeah, man. And then when did you sort of move into the travel? And did they didn't just send you out with a group. You probably had to go on a couple trips first. Yeah. So you were saying your first time traveling with the company.
Yeah. So I got really lucky, you know. I had some really good mentors that kind of, you know, groomed my path into it, especially in Kamchatka. But essentially I've done it all with shop. So I told you, I started with the summer camp with kids. And so then at the end of that summer, they brought me just into the retail floor. So then I was just hustling rods and reels and flies out of here and just fishing like crazy. Then I fell in love with the spey rod and I started swinging. And in Northern California, the vast majority of our guides and anglers fish nymphs, you know, dead drift nymphing. And so I wanted to do swing only, and I wanted to start guiding swing only on some of our local steelhead rivers, the Trinity and Klamath mostly. And so I started doing that. And then through that, I started chasing steelhead further and further away. So I started getting up to British Columbia, met a couple of lodge guys there, got some of my clients to start going up there fishing BC. And it was just a strange time in the travel department where we didn't have too many steelhead experts. And so they kind of asked me to get back there and help promote the steelhead fishing. And they kind of went out from there. And then also, that's how I got back in the travel department. But the first, when I got into actual the traveling, this is some years before that, even some of my mentors were guiding over in Kamchatka and kind of groomed me for that and had me ready to when they stepped down, they were just like, hey, Miller takes one place. So I stopped guiding locally as much and started going over there for 3-4 months at a time over to Russia.
So you single?
Yeah.
No dog?
No dog, man.
You just take off when you want.
That's it. That's exactly it, man. It's a tough game to bounce. I don't have any plants either. They don't make it.
It's pretty funny. So how, you've been doing this for a while, how has travel changed with modern technology, be it photography, GPS, fishing gadgets? You've been using a Tamander for a while. Those have definitely changed. How have you seen the industry and just gearing things change around travel fishing?
I mean, some of the stuff, you know, moves at light speed. Some of it is the same old thing. That's one of my favorite things is the rods and the reels and the lines and the flies that don't change. The stuff that worked 100 years ago is still the stuff we're doing. It might be a little bit lighter and made of graphite instead of bamboo, but yeah, our tech doesn't change that much in the actual fishing. But you're right, some of that periphery stuff, I mean, the mostly technology, right? Like, I remember when we made this movie in Kamchatka, Eastern Rises, I think that was in 2008 or something. Yeah, it was 2008, my first year in Kamchatka. And those guys hauled a stinking boom across the ocean, you know, in these airplanes, you know, through Moscow, this giant, like, 12-foot expandable stick so that they could hang cameras off it and get aerial views, you know. And now these guys, every single film is all drone done, and, you know, guys are flying their little, you know, 2-ounce cameras around on drones. And I mean, it's just a game changer. And that's in under 12 years. Same thing. We used to have those crazy, like, almost suitcase style satellite phones that were super grainy, you know, to communicate. These guys, you know, now guys will show up with housings they clip onto their iPhone to make it satellite compatible. So wow. Some of that stuff's just pretty crazy.
What about traveling over there, having an iPod. At the beginning, you probably had a Walkman or a Discman.
Yeah. Well, we might have had an actual iPod for sure. Those little micro deals. And, you know, that was right when MP3s were coming out. But yeah, now everybody just has their whole library on their phone, man. It's, you know, that's another big one too. Just watching client cameras or guides cameras go from, you know, everybody, you know, the digital SLR was awesome. And, you know, and it still is to some degree because of the lenses and everything, but geez, so many people have bailed on their little underwater point and shoots and everything just pull out their iPhones on the river for their pitch, instant gratification, show it off at night, airdrop it to all your buddies. You know, don't have to be like, take my camera and be like, don't worry, I got it. Take it on their camera, get back to camp, airdrop it, boom, done.
Yeah, it's so pretty nifty.
Yeah, the technology stuff, you know, it helps us guides from having to compile them all and doing thumb drive, you know, send outs at the end of the season for every week of the year. It's actually kind of nice.
When you have clients call up and book, is there a vetting process to make sure that these are people that can handle the travel getting there and the conditions once you get there?
No, I mean, you guys got to know that, you know, they got to take that responsibility for themselves. But I always like, you know, going through all the details with people. And I think that's really the big benefit of calling guys like me in travel departments, you know, is us being able to say, hey, what exactly are you looking for? Are you a numbers guy? Are you a big fish guy? And then, yeah, you know, explaining that, hey, I've fished this place before. This is big, fast water, big rocks. If guys are like, oh man, I got some bad knees, and then I can just say, hey, this isn't the spot, you know, let's go someplace, you know, that we can handle a little bit better. So to some degree, I mean, I'll always ask what a guy's looking for and then be able to explain like what physical requirements there are. Yeah. I'm not going to go tell a guy, nope, you didn't qualify for this program, right? He's going to cut his own throat. If he can't hack it and he gets there, you know, ultimately, man. That's how he's going to learn next time he's going to go on a boat trip instead of a wading trip, you know?
How many trips do you do in a year before there's global pandemics?
You know, it's always different. We're always trying to just stay ahead of the thing. So there's some that, you know, I take a group to every year. Like I do an annual thing in Mexico, but lots of it's just kind of spur of the moment. Just, hey, we want to see this destination. This new thing is coming out. We want to be, you know, on the ground floor getting in there, or we just need to know it so that we can market it. So sometimes, you know, we'll probably plan three a year, and then there might be a couple more spur of the moment missions to go see some stuff, you know.
Do you follow the seasons at all? Like if you want to be, you know, fishing the fall run, you'll do the Northern Hemisphere and then you spend, you know, the next.
Oh yeah.
Straight down the south.
Yeah, exactly. For us, I mean, so, you know, our travel portfolio is worldwide. So absolutely. I mean, the whole shop kind of revolves on the yearly calendar, but the strange thing is it's kind of can be flip-flop too. So, you know, in the summertime, we have all of our people in the Northern Hemisphere fishing. We have Kamchatka, Alaska, the Kola Peninsula, everybody's fishing. And some of those we have to be, you know, Kamchatka, we're really in communication with those lodges, taking care of our guides, making sure they have everything they need. But really, in the summer, when all your clients are in camps, you're actually selling the opposite, right? So Mercer will be selling chili trout trips when we're running summer stuff in the north and vice versa. So, you know, right now in the winter, you guys should be in Chile. They're not because of COVID, but, you know, guys would be in Chile, but I'd be answering phone calls for guys planning their summers in Alaska and Russia. But yeah, we're always following the fishing calendar. And then other stuff doesn't matter as much. Tropical saltwater stuff, you know, those guys book year round, so, and can fish year round.
I'm going to go on a limb and say there's probably not fully stocked shops where you're traveling. So you provide them a packing list. Are there things that each guide specifically wants or each travel host that you think people need for specific location?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, when you book with us, we do everything you need. So we call it a pre-trip, and it'll have a packing list, you know, for everything from, you know, how many pairs of long johns to pack. But then, yeah, it'll have a whole, you know, list of tackle, rods, reels, line weights, you know, your leaders, tippets, definitely a fly selection. Fly Shop does custom selections for every destination we send people on, just so that they got the bullets. And, you know, some places are all inclusive and have that stuff. And if they can, that's awesome, because they're going to have exactly what they want. But yeah, and there's no fly shops in Kamchatka. So you got to bring all your own stuff. If you forget something, you're not going to be able to go down to a corner shop and get it. So yeah, we want guys to leave our shop fully prepared. Got everything they got.
Do the guides and lodges stock up on anything just in case that they know they can make a couple bucks on?
No, I don't think there'd be any, you know, I don't know if there'd be any benefit, right? I mean, like I said, if, you know, our lodges in Chile, those guys can pre-order preseason bulk. And then, yeah, they're probably going to charge you a tax, you know, $8 flies that they paid $4 for, but they also had to pay for shipping to get it down there. I don't think it's too much of a moneymaker as it is just a lifesaver for guys. You know, in Russia, the super remote places, those guys have weight restrictions. So same thing. There's no way that a guide in Kamchatka can bring enough flies to, you know, to keep his 100 guys he's going to guide the season with fresh bugs. He'd have to bring 400 pounds worth of stuff. And that's not going to happen. So yeah, no, I don't think, you know, it's a luxury if your lodge has flies there, and they're going to be more expensive than if you bought them at home. But at the same time, those guys down there that are charging double aren't necessarily making a killing on it.
Right. There's a spot in your rust. So we've got snakeheads. And the conventional guys use topwater hollow body frogs. And there's this hole-in-the-wall convenience store for cold beer near one of these famous fishing spots. And they will sell those things for $15 plus. Just because nice. If you're there and you lose one, that's the only place you can get it.
There you go.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that's just a good business sense right there. But yeah, that guy, you know, he's just taking care of his own idea there. That's good thinking.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk Russia. Let's go with Western Russia first. We do Kola Peninsula, since we've done some Kamchatka talk. There's been nobody who's talked about the Kola Peninsula. So yeah. You could tell us, like, how far it takes, like, what's the travel like, the species, you know, what's camp life like, a typical day of fishing, and I'll just ask questions as you tell us all about Kola and why we should book a trip with you.
Yeah, you betcha. So a couple things. I mean, really, the Kola is easier to get to than Kamchatka, and far nicer accommodations and everything. You know, Kamchatka is we are way out remote. It's so far out there. For North Americans, we got a week, you know, once a week plane and everything. Kola is just north of Europe, essentially, right north of Norway. Getting there is really easy. For Europeans, it's like they're British Columbia, you know, for any West Coast steelheader, we just pop up north and go fish the Skeena system. That's exactly the Kola is that to the UK guys. You know, any European Atlantic salmon fishermen, that's what they want to do in the summer, is just pop up north to the Kola and go fishing. For us Yanks on the other side of the pond, you know, it's still super easy. So we just, you fly to Helsinki and take a charter up, or you can fly to Moscow and take a little puddle jumper from Moscow up to Murmansk. So the travel actually is super easy. Everything hugs out of the town of Murmansk. So you can just, you fly in there, and then just like on the other side in Kamchatka, you jump on the iconic Russian Mi-8 helicopter. They're just beasts. You can get 12 guys, all the guides, all the luggage out to the camp in one trip. And then the Kola is crazy, man. For as remote as they are, you know, these are hour and a half plus helicopter flights, no roads, accessibility at all, full wilderness area. And these guys' lodges are just amazing, like full on ultra comfort, you know, single occupancy rooms, in suite showers, flush toilets, just fancy. So it's quite an experience for sure.
What's the day of fishing like there? Tell us what happens when you open your eye in the morning.
So this all, pretty much all those coal rivers, especially. Okay. So the peninsula kind of has a north coast, the point, and then the rivers on the south, and they're totally different, all totally unique. The rivers on the south are Grilse rivers. The Varzuga is one of the top names down there. And these guys can catch 40, 50, 60 fish in a day. But, you know, the biggest one's 8 pounds. So they're just volume Grilse rivers. When you get to the tip of the peninsula, kind of on the point, that's probably one of the most famous iconic names in all of Atlantic salmon fishing. That's the Pinoy River. The Pinoy is rounding around that corner, so they still have high fish counts for numbers, but they can start getting some bigger fish. But still, like 20 pounds is a bigger fish on the Pinoy. And then you come around the corner and you get on that north coast of the Kola. And that is my favorite stuff. And those are high gradient, nasty rivers that big fish had to adapt to be really big and strong to navigate these rivers. Probably some of the craziest wading in the world, but some of the biggest, brightest Atlantic salmon that you can target with healthy populations. So all these rivers are above the Arctic Circle. So it is a rough environment on top of that, you know, the gradient of the rivers. It's just stark. There's no big trees, maybe some twisted little birches down in the river, but the top, you know, the top of the plateau is just like wind blown, you know, granite and tundra. Just it's crazy
brutal.
And so again, I mean, building these epic lodges out in those types of environments is just a feat, you know. It's just an amazing thing to see and be part of when you're there. But yeah, the those North Coast rivers, they're crazy. They're harsh.
What are they going to feed you at the lodge?
Oh man, they go all out.
A lot of Russian salads.
Well, I mean, usually, yeah, there's usually a good soup and everything, but it's not as full Russian as Kimchaka. Kimchaka is straight Russian, meat and potatoes. You eat the same stuff they do at their house when you go home after seasoning camp. You go back to eat your guide buddy's wife's cooking, and it's exactly what you were eating in camp, which is awesome. I love it. You know, who doesn't like meat and potatoes? But the Kola, you know, they go fancy, man. They got, you know, the ASR, they got flaming duck night. They got all you can eat king crab piles that they just caught off the mouth of the river. Like, yeah, next level food for sure.
Are you guys too tired at the end of the night to have some vodkas by the fire?
No, man. So that time of year in the summer, at that latitude above the Arctic Circle, there is no fire because there's no sunset. So it's 24-hour sun. And so we go, you know, some guys, me included, you know, like, hey, I'm on the Kola and I ain't here for a long time. So you just go mental. So usually all the best camps have a fantastic home pool where the lodge is built. And so you get helicopter, brings you back to the lodge in the evening. You go take a shower, chill out, maybe vodka, go get some amazing dinner, and then go throw your waders back on and go fish again till midnight. Fish till you die.
That sounds ideal.
It's epic. I mean, the sun never goes down. Some of the camps make mandatory rest on the pool because it's an assigned beat for somebody the next day. But some of them, man, I mean, I've been out there fishing the home pool till 2 o'clock in the morning, and you got to remind yourself, dude, you have to go to bed or you're going to ruin tomorrow. You know, it's something else. You can literally fish till you kill yourself on when the sun doesn't go down and you're looking for that one big monster grab.
Is there a crowd that gathers by that home pool?
If it's early season and you got a week with a bunch of gung-ho dudes, you know, you might have to do Rochambeau or something. So you go surf and then you go go laps. Some of the places like Yokenga has like five or six different kind of beats in that little home pool beat. And so literally you get drawn and you know you're going to be river left of the main pool on Wednesday night. That's yours. And so when you get a drawn beat for the evening after dinner, you know, you pick which days you're going to go to sleep early. If you're like, that beat's a little fast this week. It hasn't been kicking out a bunch of fish. Sweet, I'm going to go get an early night's rest. But if you got the honey draw, dang it, I'm spacing on the name of the home pool. But yeah, if you draw right or left on that one beat, you know you're staying up late. But they also kick you off, I think, at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. They rest it for the next day. But you know you're going to fish it until they literally blow a whistle and tell you to get out because the time's up.
That's got to be the last stressful couple of minutes counting down to that whistle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're like, one more cast. And you see the guy looking at his watch like, come on, baby, one big grab.
What's the rod and reel setup? What are you going to be packing for that trip?
You know, it depends on the season. So, you know, up at that latitude, we start fishing basically in early June, start fishing. That's like full runoff. So that whole area is under a sheet of ice all winter, you know? And so finally by June, it's all breaking up. And so, you know, the first week or two are a big gamble. You could show up and there's still giant chunks of ice coming down the river and it's super cold. And you can be hosed, but you can also, you know, show up and it broke last week and you're sitting on a river. So it's always going to be high and cold, but the fish could be pouring in. And those early fish are going to be the biggest, brightest, strongest fish of the whole year. So guys are gambling on those first couple weeks that they're going to get the highest quality fish ever. Those first weeks that are high and cold, you're going to be using big rods. Guys use 9s and 10 weight rods. And then depending, you know, West Coast steelheader that I am, I throw a skagit and then sink tips off of that and bigger tube flies. And then, but lots of the Euro guys, they got their own, you know, 3D guideline heads and stuff like that. But the idea is the same. We're going to be fishing deeper in that big, big, cold, fast water. As the season progresses, that water is going to get lower, clearer, warmer, and the fish are going to get kind of like steelhead. You know, the longer they're in the river, they're going to get a little bit more color. You know, those lines will get shallower and shallower so they don't splash and, you know, scare fish as much. And the flies are going to get smaller and smaller and more delicate until, you know, the end of July, guys can be waking, you know, super tiny little tube flies, or, you know, some guys even dead drift full traditional dry flies over those fish.
Is the fly choice more about your confidence in it than actually just getting a strike for some shape or form of the fly?
I think that's a big part of it, but there is some science based on conditions, right? So Schnelda is my favorite fly in the world in the middle of June. If you tied it on in the middle of July, the guides would laugh you out of the river and every single fish would blow out to the next pool the second it hit the water, you know? So you just can't fish a 4-inch, you know, aggressive, heavy fly in the middle of July because it's too scary. It lands too hard, heavy, all that stuff. But yeah, if you got, you know, in the swing game, confidence is everything, you know? Absolutely. But again, it's the conditions that kind of dictate where your confidence is going to be, you know? Same thing with winter steelhead. You know, I'm not going to fish a 4-inch intruder in July on the North Umpqua, but I'm going to fish it in February on the North Umpqua maybe. And, you know, then it's the difference between where's my confidence, pink or blue today. Right. And then I don't think pink or blue actually matters, except in the angler's head, if he's believing in one or the other. And the same goes in Atlantic salmon world for sure.
Is there any time to go and sightsee, or is it just 100% fishing? Like, there's no village out there to go visit, to bring home souvenirs, or somebody's looking
Well, there's I mean, Murmansk is a small kind of outpost town. There's a little bit you could poke around for a few days in Murmansk if you're looking for side adventures on the way. But really the thing to do is go see something else in Russia, you know, like go spend 4 days in Moscow, go see Red Square, go see the Kremlin, you know, go see Lenin's tomb, you know, go see all the Rembrandts in the museums there, and then take the puddle jumper to Murmansk and go fishing for the next week. But yeah, I probably wouldn't do a 4-day Murmansk sit and look for any touristy stuff. But the rest of Russia is so cool, and it's all on that European side. So actually, one of my favorite trips ever, we planned this thing. I planned it for 4 years, but last in 2018, the World Cup was in Russia. And, you know, those guys were playing in June. And I was like, oh, this is too easy. So I set up a hosted trip for the Okanga, and we spent a week in St. Petersburg, caught a World Cup soccer game, saw Messi's first goal, Argentina versus Nigeria, you know, spent a week hanging out in St. Petersburg, seeing all that, watching football, and then popped over, you know, to do a week on the Okanga. It's like a 3-hour flight out of St. Petersburg to Murmansk. So those kind of combos. There's tons of side stuff to do, but it'd be a flight involved. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So there's someone that might go on our fishing trips here that likes to hit up Tinder in not so exotic locations.
What, say it again? Sorry.
So there's a guy that'll fish with us, and he may go on Tinder sometimes when we're in these locations and try and meet some companionship while we're in town. Do you ever have to book an extra seat back because a Russian mail order bride has joined the crew, picked up?
I have not seen that. You know, I bet that old thing might work in Moscow or St. Pete, but I bet it'd be slim pickings in Murmansk or Petropavlovsk. So I haven't seen too many guys get stuck with that deal.
And have you picked up Russian? You can converse, you just know the bad words like me?
Yeah, no, man, I definitely started with the bad words, but I've been guiding over there for since 2008. So, I mean, I've spent a lot of time on the ground now. So, but yeah, you know, my first couple of years, definitely it was the bad words first, but now I can get by pretty well. You know, I mean, I can pretty much talk about fishing, camp, rivers, weather, direction, food. I can order all that stuff that would happen in camp. I tell people I know bush Russian, you know, and I can get through restaurants and stuff like that in town. Yeah, we're definitely not talking about, you know, geopolitics in Russian, that's for sure.
Yes, there are no geopolitics in Russian. It's just Russian politics.
Yeah, that's it. It's this way or no way.
Yeah, so you've been going there for a long time. Do you have a good relationship? Do you look forward to seeing the same employees year after year?
Oh, yeah, man. Dude, some of those guys are my brothers, for sure.
Do you ever have to bring them stuff from America?
Oh, every time. They'll get pissed if I don't bring them some of that stuff.
What do you bring in?
So American tobacco, mandatory. For some reason, Marlboro Reds taste better when they're bought in America than when they're bought in Russia. I don't believe it because their smokes are $1 a pack and ours are $10 a pack, but apparently they say it's worth it. And then the chew, they can't get chew at all. And so the Americans showed them that poison. And so they're always begging for that. And then
mouthwash with all the nicotine.
Huh?
Did you ever bring them gum or mouthwash if they're chewing and smoking the whole time?
No. They're not concerned with that. No way. The other big thing is Levi's. So a pair of Levi's is like $350. So the boys will send me their sizes, be like, you know, bring me this size Levi's, you know, and be like, ah, cool, get there, be like $80 or whatever you paid for it, right? And then it blows their mind. They're like, I'm gonna be such a badass at the bar when we get out of camp rolling Levi's. People think I'm rich. So it's always funny some of the stuff they like, but yeah, they love those Levi's and American tobacco, I guess.
Crazy. Before the Iron Curtain fell, that was still a huge thing.
Yeah. Iconic, man.
Yeah.
Anything else about the cola that I didn't ask you before we jump over to Kamchatka?
I don't know. I mean, there's so much, but yeah, I think we covered it pretty well.
Let's do the same thing with Kamchatka, the same question. So
cool.
That's got to be an easier flight just across the Pacific.
So, you know, people have gotten accustomed to it and people love it. And it kind of gives it that, yeah, the allure of easy, accessible. But in reality, I mean, so we get a flight that runs 7 flights a year, once a week for 7 weeks. In the core of our season, basically all it does is we fill that plane with fishermen. There's a few other people, maybe volcanologists, some hikers, but not many, mostly fishermen. And, you know, so you still got to get up to Alaska overnight in Alaska. And then that flight, it pops on over, in my opinion. And I'm good at flying, but the Moscow route isn't all that bad. It's only 2 flights out of LA. So we fly LA to Moscow, Moscow to PK. And you can choose to overnight in that or not. I usually do for comfort, but yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing. We talk about it every day at the shop. People, you know, if we take that airplane away, people will be like, I'm not going, it's too far. And really it's not that bad at all to go through Moscow, but yeah, the flight makes it easy for sure. At least in people's minds.
There was a big gap in when people could travel to Kamchatka. Correct.
There's been a couple years where it's fallen. We lost a flight in 2019, and then we lost a flight in 2006 and 2007. But we still operate. Like I said, we still go through Moscow. If that airplane dies, there's still 1,000 ways to get there. Just not the ultra convenient one, right?
Yeah. So how far into the bush are you going there?
So the Kamchatka Peninsula is roughly the size of California, and they basically have one town. So it'd be like flying into San Francisco on your commercial flight and then hanging out in just that town. And from there, anywhere we go, we got to go by helicopter, MI-8 helicopter. And so in our trout programs, we have 3 areas that we operate out of. So we got the Northern Rivers. That's where the Sedanka and the Wilderness floats are. Those are the furthest in helicopter time. And that's like about 3 hours one way. And you got to stop in a town called Esso and refuel and then poke back out to the river. That's probably the longest one. And our Kamchatka Steelhead project in the fall, that's what I still run. That's similarly way out there near those rivers to the north. Northwest.
So I think most of us picture Kamchatka from the Eastern Rises movie, which is just huge trout rising up to mice on pretty much any cast you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
My God.
That's real. That's real. So that movie is you know, it's that movie is filmed on 3 or 4 of our different programs. And so lots of times people just, you know, they meld it together and think that it's one big experience. But really you kind of got to pick your area. You got to be like, okay, I'm going to go do this. And there's some places, the Sedanka, for example, is just high population density river. It's a spring creek. There's a billion fish there. And those fish average like 18 to 22 inches, maybe is like the average. And like they top out around 25 inches, but those fish are all on mice. And then if you hit a hatch, like we did in that movie, then you can get those sippers, those fish rising on traditional dry flies. And you just go pick your way down and just slay on traditional flies. But you get guys that are like, yeah, I catch plenty of fish at home. On dries, I'm here to mouse, and guys will just rip mice right through, you know, 100 rising noses, and they'll just whack them on the mouse all the whole time, right? And that's the whole thing with trout, right? The old opportunistic feeder. So they might be gorging on a mayfly hatch. If a mice comes by, they're still going to eat it no matter what.
Wow.
Yeah.
You ever get tired of hooking topwater trout or mice?
Nah, man, you really don't. You just don't. It is something else every single time. every time watching those things just chase behind it, short strike, grab it, jump out. You know, you never know how a fish is going to take it. I got a couple theories, but yeah, I mean, they'll attack from behind. They'll attack super soft, almost like they're sipping a mayfly. Then they'll just do the murder. You know, my favorites are the ones that jump out of the water and land on it on the way back down. Those ones are unforgettable.
What's the mouse pattern of choice? First or lemming?
No. So we found out, you know, a while ago, basically with the number one fly hands down that we use now is Hickman's Mr. Hanky. The thing is awesome. It you know, it casts well, it fishes well, but most importantly, it's the least lethal. And so we pretty much had to outlaw a couple flies, Mercer's Lemming being one of them. And then Kenny Morris's Moorish Mouse was one of the favorites of all time. But those flies had solid shank, long shank hooks that rode down. And so the foam would be over them. And those fish, if they hit it hard, they'd catch it in the bottom gill rakers. And it was like a 50% mortality rate. We were killing half the fish we caught. And it was no bueno. So Mr. Hanky came out. And it has an extended trailer hook that's upriding. And so it's way back with the tail, rides up. And we tend to hook fish on the hard palate in the top of the mouth, in the lips way more, far less mortality. And so basically we switched everybody over. We're like, we banned solid shank downriding hooks over there. We're like, this is the only fly that we're doing. But it was awesome. So Morris, you know, we told him that, and he's like, what the hell? We're not selling the fly anymore. And so we told him the scoop, and he went out, and he's now come out with the Moorish Mouse 2.0. Dang, fish is awesome. And all he did is take his same Moorish Mouse pattern and make an upriding trailer hook, catches just as many fish, kills a tenth of them, you know? So yeah, it's basically all about the design and preventing unnecessary fish mortality. That's how I choose a mouse fly, to be honest.
When you're doing the trout fishing, are there any other bycatch things that might come up and eat a mouse?
Oh yeah. So the mouse actually is kind of a selective deal. So you're actually if you fish a streamer over there, you can like get pissed. There's too many fish, you know. So if you just put on a black leech or something that looks fishy, you're going to catch every fish in the river. And then the big bycatch that's really cool and unique is there's a char species over there called Akunja. That's the local word. I guess our word, we call it a Siberian white spotted char. So same family as a Dolly Varden, but this thing is a pretty ferocious predator fish. They're about the same size as the trout, you know, top out at 25 inches on the Sedanka and stuff. And they're resident on that river, and they'll eat the mouse a little bit, but if you put on a streamer, you're going to catch more Kunja than rainbows. You're going to keep your rainbow numbers up, but I mean, you'll be taking off 150 fish a day. So most guys, they'll put on the mouse because they can still catch 30, 40 rainbows in a day. And, you know, cut down a little bit on some of the other stuff that won't stay off the line of the streamer. And then the other really interesting one in Kamchatka is they have a sixth Pacific salmon that we don't have on our side of the pond. So they have all the same ones we do. They got Chinook, Coho, Chums, Pinks, and Sockeyes. Those are the five Pacific salmon that we have on our side in Alaska. And whatever, but they have another one called a cherry salmon or a masu, and the Sedanka has those, and I've actually caught those on mice, but you can sight them when they get darker, and run pink streamers to them and catch those. That's pretty cool. That's usually a pretty unique fish for guys to check off their bucket list.
What else are you going to see out there during a day of fishing? Big eagles,
the eagles.
Bears.
The eagles are a big one, and the bears, you know, and I mean, then that's really it. Everybody actually is always really surprised at the lack of big mammal wife in Kamchatka. For some reason, it just didn't evolve and do great there. The bears got huge eating fish, but there's not too much else as far as big predators. They got some foxes. We'll see red foxes out there. They got wolves to the north. I've never seen them. They got some giant moose. They got some caribou, but both of those are few and far between. But you'll see bears daily, and then that stellar sea eagle is something else. Thing is ginormous.
How about the wildflowers in the summer?
There can be some really good ones. There can be some really good ones. Mostly though, lots of our fishing is just down in the tundra. So lots of it's just spongy. It's vibrantly green. Around springs and stuff, you'll see a little bit of color, but not crazy in terms of color. But the greenness of it is striking. If you see pictures of Kamchatka in July, early August, it's just like fluorescent green. It's something else.
Wow. How would your fishing setup differ if you're doing trout versus steelhead?
Basically exactly the same as it would here at home. You know, we don't nymph that all over there. That's one of the beauties over there, is we don't have to do the egg peg bead thing like you do often in AK when the salmon are spawning. So, and it depends on the river. The Sedanka, we'll stick with that. We've been talking about that. That's 9'6" and a real aggressive fly line. So the fly line is, that was one of the biggest, actually, we were talking about earlier, advancements in technology. When I first started guiding over there, guys were bringing over their 6-weight rod and a 6-weight trout line, which is designed to turn over a parachute atoms, and then we'd tie a mouse on it. It'd be rough. It's like putting a bass popper on a trout taper, you know, and it was a struggle. But these lines now, these ultra aggressive integrated shooting heads, like the Scientific Angler Titan taper, are mouse punching machines, man. They're so cool. So we tie a 4-foot leader, onto the end of a Titan taper and put a mouse on, and guys can throw that thing a country mile with crazy accuracy. They're amazing.
And that's not going to tire you out casting that all day.
Way less than it would if you were on a trout line. You know what I mean? Like that line does all the work for you. The mouse goes for a ride on that line instead of on a real trout line where you feel like you're trying to muscle the mouse through the wind. This thing, the line's going, the fly has to follow it, you know? So it's a pretty cool thing. But that's, that's single-handed 9'6" stuff up on the north on the Sedanka. Our other river, probably the most famous river in Kamchatka, arguably after the Sedanka, is the Shaponava. And the Shaponava is a trophy river. I mean, I've tape measured fish that were 35-inch rainbows, probably weighed 17, 18 pounds, and had never been to the ocean. I mean, I've caught steelhead that are half that size. They're just big, beastly rainbows that don't run to salt. They're just kick-ass. Those we got to gun up a little bit. So we'll run 8-weights for those guys. Same thing, tight and taper with a mouse or type 3, 15-foot type 3 sink tips and streamers targeting those trophy suckers. And then for steelhead, then the whole game changes, and 99% of the steelheaders are going to bring a spay rod now. So, we're looking for a trophy rainbow at 30 inches on the Shaponava. That's going to be a guy's fish of a lifetime for his rainbow career. And, that's entry-level steelhead on the Kamchatka Steelhead Project. They probably average 31 to 32 inches. A fish under 30 inches is rare, right? A fish over 30 inches in trout fishing is a giantly big deal. So when we're steelhead fishing, we're running 7-weight spay rods, super light tips. Those are low gradient, slow tundra type rivers, so we don't have to be deep, but yeah, we're going to gun up with those bigger spay rods.
Do you get into taming at all?
I've not. They don't have them on the Kamchatka side. They got them on the mainland side of Russia, and I've not been over to do that. Or have I been to Mongolia or any other places they lived.
Okay.
Definitely on the bucket list for sure.
When they're cooking you meat and potatoes, is it just meat or do they actually tell you what it is?
No, well, groundhog? So that's actually a funny question. So I don't think I've ever seen like fresh beef in Kamchatka. So 99% of the time, you know, when we're eating meat, we're eating pork and chicken. And the pork is fantastic. I'll eat their, you know, so they'll do, you know, pork chops, whatever. So lots of fried meats, breaded, you know, lots of meat in soups. So they do ton of meats and soups and stuff like that. So yeah, but yeah, you're not gonna go see a steak on the grand finale night in Kamchatka, that's for sure.
What do you eat when you're drinking the vodka over there?
Oh, good question,
onions,
man.
Peas, pickles.
Yes. Well, so the easy one is pickles, bread, tomatoes, cheese, and kielbasa, salami. You know, some sort of sausage. That's the easy platter. But the best thing in the world to do it is with red caviar. So salmon eggs, red salmon eggs, like you're chasing vodka with Potsky's Great Balls of Fire, but it's way better than it sounds.
I haven't had a vodka and pickle in about 6 o'clock today. It's last time. My neighbor had vodka last night.
Exactly, man. That is the good stuff right there.
Yeah. And he came down. There's a little itty bitty incline, but we had a little bit of snow last night. So I was waiting for him to come to the kitchen and I look outside and I just see this imprint in the snow where it looks like somebody fell and wiped out pretty hard. And then he came by 20 minutes later, said he got so wet from falling he had to go change all his clothes.
No way.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then we were supposed to get 7 inches of snow. There's not even a dusting.
Yeah, the weather, stinking weather, man. Probably went golf and kept everybody else at home.
Right. Speaking of weather, what you ever experienced something crazy in the Russia Far East or Far West that just blew your mind? I've seen some storms before on trips that we were talking about one last night on Martha's Vineyard where our whole tent, the ground was shaking all night from thunder and we couldn't sleep.
Yeah, totally, man. So I was just going to say, I've had some wind out on the tundra that you thought was going to shred your tents. That can get kind of scary. But yeah, you know, you travel enough, you see Mother Nature get some. Russia, I think that's the craziest I've seen is the wind. And then, I mean, I've seen some rain events like nothing else, but I can't say I've seen it there. I've seen some heavy rains, but I've seen heavier in the Amazon. And actually, I was just in Louisiana for redfish. And that was, I saw it. We had a day that was probably some of the hardest rain I'd ever seen in my life. Amazon rainforest-esque for sure. But out there in the tundra, it's the wind. When you got nothing stopping it coming off an ocean, you know, no trees, no cover, and you just got a tent pitched on flat tundra. Whew, man, that can get gnarly.
Yeah. Do the locals ever tell you to worry about like Russian Sasquatch or Baba Yaga?
No, man, no. So that whole thing in Eastern Rises with the Iroquium, I think they were all just pulling Frank's leg. Yeah, you never hear dudes talk about it at all. And then I never heard about it on the Kola side at all either, but I should bring it up with those boys. I spent a lot more time in Kamchatka, and they all, no, it's not real. It's not real. It's only story.
It's only story till you get taken in the middle of night.
That's it. Yeah. Yep.
What are some of the other
99% of the people here would say the same thing, you know?
Yeah. What are some of your other favorite travel destinations you get to do with work? And do you ever get to go scout out places beforehand that your company hasn't done business with?
Yeah, we definitely do some of that. You know, I mean, for our business though, I mean, we don't often get to go to some place that doesn't have something ready to market, right? So you, essentially, you're going to be established by the time we're like, okay, we're going to do business with you. So that means, you know, you you have a fishery that you know is already good. You already have a lodge, you have chefs, like you can provide a product that isn't gonna, you know, embarrass us and piss off our guys, right? So often there's that, but you know, so I'll give you an example. Those, the African Waters guys, I mean, I've been watching those guys for years, and they have all these killer programs. They got the tiger fish in Tanzania. They got those Nile perch in Cameroon. They do the GT trigger thing up in the Sudan, you know, all these just killer things. Those giant fish off of Gabon, you know, and I was always like, man, these guys are awesome. And I bet we could market that stuff, but we didn't have Africa, mainland Africa. We did the Seychelles, but it was always there. And then, so those guys came out and did a tour in the States and hit up a bunch of local clubs. We invited them to come do a presentation with us. And I was so pumped to see it, you know? And so, you know, all of our travel guys went there and saw this thing. And the guys were like, man, we'd love to work with you. We'd love to get, you know, do something. And the boss is like, yeah, no, we totally should. We've all been watching you for a long time. But it's one of those things where you're like, okay, let's plan it for next season. Then it takes me another year to get it in the catalog and get the market in. It could be like a 2-year deal before, you know, we're established and selling that trip. And so these guys were like, well, actually we had some crazy cancellations next week. And we were writing the catalog at the time. And so I got to ask the boss, I'm like, hey man, this is our opportunity. We could have this thing in the catalog with boots on the ground experience by the end of the month. And he's like, son of a gun. All right, you go do it. And it was nuts. From when I met those guys to when I was standing in Tanzania chasing tiger fish was under 6 days, but it was awesome. And it was absolutely out of this world fishing. Just, I came home like, we're crazy for not having this in the catalog sooner. We've been all about getting behind that destination, and I'm super pumped to work a lot more with those guys and bring on some of those other crazy African jungle missions, because that first one I went was absolute next level, man. Tanzania tiger fish, that's probably one of my new faves.
I never got north enough into the Okavango to find those fish, but I would definitely like to wrestle with them one day.
Dude, they're so cool. I would go out of my way to make that happen.
Yeah. Anything about the fly shop and you I forgot to ask before I got some other just questions at the end?
I
do don't know. The old days of the catalog when it was, you know, half an inch thick, when it was like a phone book.
Yeah. And on newsprint. My favorite's when we dig those things up and, you know, we'll be, yeah, the boss will pull one of those things out and just be like, oh my God, look at this one from 1982. And they're selling those like rubber boot foot, you know, waders and stuff. And you're just like, holy smokes. It's cool. It's iconic, you know?
I've been watching the evolution of steelhead flies you guys have sold throughout the years.
Yeah. That's totally.
Yeah, the new catalog we just got from you is upstairs on the next to the kitchen sofa, right?
Cool.
Peruse it at leisure.
We love that. That's why we keep doing it. You know, some guys are like, man, I just want to see it on my phone. But that's something we take a lot of pride in, is that guys get the catalog and don't throw it away. And they look at it throughout the year, pick it up. Our favorite one ever is when a guy says, yeah, that's what sits on the back of the toilet.
I was about to say, in college, we had every catalog imaginable in our bathrooms.
That's it. That's the best praise we get.
I tell my clients.
If our catalog's on the top of the stack in the bathroom, we're stoked.
I tell my clients, if you want to learn all the names of the flies, just put the catalog next to the toilet.
That's it, man. That's exactly right.
Yeah. All right, I got some nonsensical questions. We'll round this out.
Okay.
Who's got the best sandwich in Redding?
Oh, man. I'm about to go there today. We just found this guy. Actually, he's called Lucky Miller's. He's over off 273, man. I've been there like 3 times this month. It is next level. I don't know how I didn't know about him before.
What's your order?
Oh, man, we've been trying everything. Guy does burgers, too. He's got this elk burger that's like 3 meals, man, but it is like nothing else. It's crazy, off the hook. But if you don't want to kill yourself with a 4-pound burger, I'm way into the hot pastrami right now.
And I'm just jealous. You know, California cuisine in general is just awesome.
It is. It is, man.
I've not been out to California in 10 years, I think.
Well, for us, the staple, at least 3-4 times a week, I eat Mexican food. And that's always, I feel terrible for people that don't have quality Mexican food in their state. I hope you guys do.
We have everything you can imagine and more where we live.
There you go.
We got a Uyghur Chinese restaurant up the street.
What?
Uyghur, the group in China that's basically being murdered out of existence in slave camps. But yeah, it's spelled U-I-G-H-E-R, Uyghur. Yeah, it's like the group of Chinese people that are enslaved and all sorts of horrible things.
Well, I'm looking that up.
Yeah, you can get any cuisine in the world where we live.
That's
clients up the street own a Vietnamese restaurant.
I love Vietnamese. That's been a new jam for me too.
Yeah, banh mi. We have a whole Vietnamese shopping center about 15 minutes from here. Everything in the shopping center is Vietnamese.
So growing up in the Bay, that's the epicenter of food down there. You can get anything from any place. It's not quite as diverse up here in Redding for eating, but we still got a little bit.
Yeah. And then Peruvian chicken is one thing that no one else has but us. People hear about it all the time in this podcast.
What's it called?
Just Peruvian chicken.
All right.
It's marinated, charcoal roasted. You get half whole or quarter, and you get two sides. It's just the best chicken, and you can't find a recipe for it. No one
really. I just wrote it down. I was gonna try to poach some.
Yeah, we have one in the Korean neighborhood down the street.
Dang. All right.
Next question. What is your favorite Samuel L. Jackson movie?
Pulp Fiction, gotta be.
Yes. Do you have any vices or bad habits that you need to break? Not having a spouse, you probably don't have to break any bad.
Yeah, that's got to be a long list. Surely my mom would tell me I got to stop smoking someday.
Yes. Any superstitions?
Yeah, I don't use white lighters.
Yeah, my brother always told me never use white lighters.
Bad mojo, buddy. You put a jinx on the whole damn thing.
Yeah. What is something that goes with you on all of your local to exotic fishing destinations?
Headlamp.
Brand, make, and model?
Just for easy use, old Petzl Tinka. But that sucker goes through batteries, man. I curse it out a lot.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Black Diamond. You've got...
Yeah.
House has got one of those. Yeah.
I had a Black Diamond that was like the surface of the sun. That thing was so bright.
So if you are going to come out to D.C. for some bluegill and Peruvian chicken, and you into come over, it. What's your drink? What do I have to prepare for you?
Oh, geez. If it's hot, gin and tonic.
Yeah, we can definitely.
If it's cold, steelhead and whiskey.
Nice. Got plenty of that. Friends just dropped off a whole bottle of Hudson bourbon.
There you go, man. Yeah, I'm all about bourbon.
If you had to be isolated, other than COVID restrictions, you know, where in the world would you want to be stuck fishing? You had like your Bill Murray Groundhog Day.
Oof. Oh, so you don't have to worry about seasons?
Yeah, if you were stuck in the same place day after day, it was the same.
Probably be on a tributary of the Skeena, nice, chasing steelhead every day.
What's up with rods on shoulders?
I hear that a lot, actually. I think some guys just like showing off, but I like I like the fancy S handle click paw only. And if you put that damn thing in the water and it gets sand in it, and locks up, and it's a pain in the ass to get apart.
That best answer you have right there.
Yep, prop it up on your shoulder, just keep it out of the water, so you don't have to deal with fixing it.
If you were allowed to have any pet, wild, exotic, domestic, regardless of laws and regulations, what pet would you own?
Oh man, I've been looking. I got this skunk in my backyard that we're actually getting cool. He can just walk by now, and I don't jump up and run in the house. And I was like, man, that'd be so cool if I had a pet skunk.
They're supposed to be awesome pets if you get the gland to take out.
I've heard they're totally awesome pets. And it's so cool looking. You'd have the shock value. Everybody that looked at you would be like, oh, my God. But
it's hilarious.
Yeah, they're bitching. Probably, too, you could borrow some hair for tying some flies every once in a while. You wouldn't mind.
Yeah. Final question. What's that one fish that got away that still haunts your memories that you want to do over?
Probably this is a good one. So probably this one fish in the Thompson, but the Thompson is the holy grail of steelhead fishing, in my opinion. And unfortunately, somehow we let it die. I remember before I ever fished it, reading this book, and it said, you know, the fish in the Thompson are so strong. He said that one in four fish in that river is unlandable. And that idea to me that you could hook a steelhead that no matter what you did was unlandable, he was going to kick your ass all over the place. That idea like sucked me into this place. Like, I just want one fish that's unlandable. That's it. And sure as hell, I touched him one time and it was something else. I've never felt lightning like that. And that's just big water. Fish could run for a kilometer without ever going around a corner and just spool you seven times. But yeah, I remember hooking him. I remember watching him porpoise on the way down and just seeing he was giant and unbroken lightning gone. I just remember sitting there holding that limp line, just being like, oh my God, I just wanted to see him a little bit closer, you know?
Beautiful. All right, Mr. Miller, where can listeners find you to book a trip, either in person or through the internets?
Yeah, easy. The flyshop.com, man, is theflyshop.com. Super easy to find. My email is even easier, justin@theflyshop.com. Give me a shout. Talk about fishing anywhere in the world, man.
Yeah, man. And also, I was wondering, you know, you guys are the only ones that sell second rod tips.
Yeah. They come with our spay rods and our single handers. Yep.
Yeah, I asked Rosenbauer. I was like, well, you know, if you can just mail people replacement tips, why can't someone just proactively just buy a spare tip from Morvis? He's like, we're just stuck just trying to make rods right now.
So, yeah, I bet. Yeah, no. Getting stuff manufactured right now is a doozy.
Yes. All right, my man. Well, yeah, cool. I'm jealous of your travel and fishing and getting to work in the fly shop.
Right on, man. Well, Rob, it's really great to meet you, dude. And thank you so much for reaching out. That was fun.
Yeah, man. Thanks. And hopefully I can get out to California soon.
Dude, anytime you want to come swing a fly, brother, you know where I'm at.
All right, man. Thanks again.
Cheers. Can't wait to listen to it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Rob. Later.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for the Fly Fishing Consultant Podcast. For more information or to contact Rob, please go to www.robsnowwhite.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Freestone Productions at freestoneproductions.com.